This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we will visit with Christy Nichols. She is the Commissioner of Administration for Governor Bobby Jindal. And, of course, the legislative session is less than 2 months away, starting April the 8th, and the budget will be first and foremost. We'll talk with Christy Nichols about what's going to happen as far as dollars and cents at the state capitol. This coming after A.E. Hotchner, the famed biographer and friend of Ernest Hemingway, and also an associate of Steven Soderbergh and Paul Newman. A.E. Hotchner is still doing his thing at the age of 92, and he has some thoughts about being vital in his 90s. All this today, but first the news on 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Your numbers are 297-5633 and 877-217-5757. We begin with A.E. Hotchner, the effervescent and charismatic nonagenarian. A.E.'s a lifelong writer, and his latest work is O.J. in the Morning, G&T at Night. A.E. Hotchner, of course, is best known as the best-selling biographer of his close friend, Ernest Hemingway. The book Papa Hemingway, of course, is the definitive work about Ernest Hemingway. And A.E.'s memoir, King of the Hill, was adapted into a film in 1993 by none other than Steven Soderbergh of Baton Rouge. In addition to his writing, Hotch is the co-founder, along with Paul Newman, of Newman's Own Foods and the Hole in the Wall Gang, camp for sick children, and he lives in Connecticut with his wife and, appropriately, a parrot named Ernie. Good morning, Hotch. How are you?
Okay, Jim. How are you doing there?
I'm doing well, and you sound fantastic, and I don't think you mind us mentioning that you are 92 years young.
That's exactly where I am.
How have you done it? You've kept your mind, your wits, your vitality. You've done it like few others.
Well, that's what I've done in this little book of mine that just come out. I want to tell everybody who wants to read it that they can still have a good time as they get older. You know, we have a kind of a demarcation when you're supposed to get old and older. Huh. At 60, you're a senior. And so right away you have a mantle on you that you're getting old, you're 60. And then at 65, you're Social Security. And the older you get, the more you begin to sort of weigh down under the weight of getting old, and that's ridiculous. My idea has been from the beginning, you're who you are, and go on, have a good time, and enjoy your life. You might have to change it a bit, but that's the point. You know, be yourself, and don't listen to these adjectives that are attached to your name. You're an old fellow and all that stuff. Your kids start to treat you that way. Just be as young as you feel, and that's it. Dwight Eisenhower said, he said, I'll go to a rocker when I feel that way, and I don't know. And he was, at that point, he was 80. So there you go.
Mm-hmm. Well, you say when youngsters in their 70s or 80s lurch toward the horizon of 90, they ask you, what's your secret? And you tell them, O.J. in the morning.
Right. Orange juice in the morning, gin and tonic at night, and you'll be all right.
Well, you've gotten to 92 in good shape, and I would say probably you have not led a life of moderation.
No, I have lived fully, and I mean, you couldn't really be around Hemingway for 14 years and sort of pamper yourself. And all the years with Newman, we lived very well. But we didn't abuse, we didn't do anything to ourselves that can shorten our time here. Unfortunately, he did die a few years ago, but of leukemia, and that you can do nothing about.
Well, you have a parrot, as I noted, named Ernie, and Ernie occasionally is a bit irreverent, isn't he?
He has a personality that I've copied. Ernie just is about rude to any and everybody, and nice to any and everybody. There were a couple of very proper ladies came to visit me a year ago, and they came into the room, and Ernie spotted them, and he said, I love you, I love you. And they said, oh, what a darling parrot. Let's go see what he's... And they walked over to him, and he said, kiss my ass. So that shows you.
A.E. Hotchner, better known as Hotch to his friends, his book, his latest, I think his 19th, O.J. in the Morning, G&T at Night, and the G&T is gin and tonic. How many gins and tonic?
One gin and tonic, but if you're festive, you can do another half, but they shouldn't be heavy. They're light. And then, of course, the nutrition is you should always have 3 lime squeezes with them. That's the nutrition, the lime. So at least that's my take on it, and that allows me to indulge myself. But I think that's that's necessary. I think you've got to treat yourself to whatever yourself likes.
You quote Frank Lloyd Wright as saying, the longer I live, the more beautiful life becomes.
Well, that's repeated again and again by very well-known people, famous people, through their lives. In the book, many of them have that to say. Some of them are quite funny. George Burns, on his 87th birthday, somebody in the audience at one of his shows said, George, you're 87 today. What would you like as a birthday present? And right back he said, a paternity suit.
Well, our former governor, Edwin Edwards, is expecting a child later this year. His wife is expecting, and he is the father. He will be 86 when Edwin Jr., if it's a boy, I think that will be the name, when Edwin Jr. is born. So life does not necessarily end when you're 80 or 90 years old.
That's a testament to my theory. Well, I had my children late in life, but it's paid off very well. They still are comforting and supportive and a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm. How old were you?
I enjoy them.
How old were you, Hotch, when your children were born?
The first one, I was about 35, 36. But those are the first two, the girls. But the young man, I was in my 50s.
And,
so there's no rules about this stuff.
Yeah, you've seen your children grow up, and that's wonderful. OJ in the morning, G&T at night from A.E. Hotchner. You mentioned Ernest Hemingway, as have I, your close friend of 14 years. You have written more intricately and intimately about him than anybody else. He died on July 2nd, 1961. That's almost 52 years ago. Do you recall that day?
Well, vividly, I recall everything about Ernest. Ernest lived the kind of life that ignited your own. Not that he ever imposed his style of life on you, but he was such a vibrant person that you necessarily inherited his vibrancy when you were around him. At least the first 12 years I knew him were great. The last 2 years were not great. He began a rather steady decline, and he couldn't really enjoy his life much more. But he had lived so riotously, and he had lived up his life so much that he had nothing left. And so that's been my theory, too. You don't really, I mean, your years are like they're in a bank account. You draw them out. Either you draw them out in a responsible way, or else you can take them out in big lumps and use them up. So I think that's part of it. Live your life responsibly to yourself, and you're going to be around for quite a while.
Hemingway was only 61 when he took his life.
I know, but if you saw him and were around him as I was, he looked like he was in his upper 80s, and he was acting that way.
Was he insane at the time?
He was, I wouldn't use the word insane, but he certainly was, he was of a mind that he wanted to leave the earth, and he had an aberration about destroying himself. So before he actually committed suicide, there were a couple of harrowing incidents that I had to participate in. Unfortunately, when he tried to kill himself, and we were able to stop him from doing it. But, yeah, I mean, if you want to call that kind of insanity, I think anybody who wants to commit suicide is in a state that you might lump under the general term insanity. You certainly lose any sense of control over your actions.
Well, you've had ups and downs in your life. You have lost people you have loved, including Ernest Hemingway, and women you loved in a different way. How have you survived and kept your wits and your spirit?
Yeah, I've lost some very, very close friends. I lost a marvelous composer named Cy Coleman, who wrote 5 or 6 of the great Broadway musicals and whose songs are still sung and performed everywhere. You lose these people, and they leave cavities in your life, but then you have to fill them up with the people you enjoy. I think as you get older, it's a very important thing to have friends and acquaintances who are younger. Not necessarily very younger, but younger than you are. And it gives you a feeling of bridge with the coming generations. I mean, this whole explosion of the electronic world. I mean, we take our cell phones and everything for granted, but at one time they were very trying on a generation that had been raised on telephones and typewriters and manual typewriters. Mm-hmm. So I think it's necessary to be around younger people.
You are one of the younger people that you have cultivated as a friend, I guess, in many ways he cultivated you, is Steven Soderbergh, recently turned 50 years old, grew up right here in Baton Rouge, and as I stated earlier, King of the Hill, your memoir, was adapted into a film by Steven. That was his second movie. That was the one after Sex, Lies, and Videotape. How well do you know him?
Well, it was a very puzzling beginning for me, because King of the Hill is a memoir of my year, a summer of my life when I was 12 years old during the depth of the Depression. Now, that would be about 1933. So the book had been out for a couple of years when I got a call from Robert Redford, who's an old friend whom I knew through Paul Newman. And Bob said, listen, I have a young friend who's a filmmaker, and he's told me about a book of yours that came out that he would like to acquire as a movie. And he said his name is Steven Soderbergh, and he's, I don't know what he was then, 28? He was young. And I said, well, Bob, you know, what would he have in the way of a feeling for the period and what's happening? When he's so young, he would have no connection. So Soderbergh got hold of me and convinced me that the feelings and emotions of a 12-year-old at that time were the same as they were in his time and in every time, that they were universal. So after many meetings, I went along with him. I went to St. Louis. It was all photographed in St. Louis. And I spent the whole time there. Sometimes we reworked things right at the time of shooting. But he's a very inventive director. It was wonderful. I learned a lot from him. And we became good friends.
He's quite a man. He's done remarkable work, and it's been going now for 25 years. So he has stood the test of time, as have you, A.E. Hotchner. O.J. in the morning, G&T at night. From this remarkable man, Carole King, one of your friends, says you don't need to be an elder to appreciate this nonagenarian's wise and witty take on getting older. All you need is a heart and a sense of humor. Bravo, Hotch. Thank you, A.E. Hotchner, for spending time with us this morning.
She's a good friend. I used to do galas with Newman. We did these camps for kids. They still exist all over the world, who have cancer and other life-threatening diseases. And at the end of the year, I'd put on a big gala with celebrities, and we raised a lot of money, and Carole King was one of them.
And we'll return after this 90-second pause on WRKF. This is Jim Engster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. Outside the area, it's 877-217-5757. And Engster Show at WRKF.org works online. Because of our special guest in studio, Monday we will hear from Kirby Goidell of LSU and Jeff Nagel from Tulane, and they have some fascinating information regarding childhood statistics and some of the issues in regarding childhood development, and they have done a major study on this, and we will talk with them come Monday. But Christy Nichols is with us. She is the Commissioner of Administration for Governor Bobby Jindal. Good morning to you, Christy.
Good morning, Jim.
And you have been in the administration for a while under different umbrellas. So how's the new job going?
It's going very well. We've been hard at work. I moved over to the division in October, and obviously since that time we've been working mainly on the budget, and obviously we presented the executive budget to the joint budget on Friday, and are moving through the process of getting ready for session and going through that deliberative process on the budget itself.
Now, you're a graduate of the University of Tennessee.
I am.
And the University of Louisiana Lafayette.
More importantly, yes.
Yeah.
That's right. Raging Cajuns, go.
So you're familiar with Louisiana, and you've been familiar with the Jindal administration in various capacities, and now you're in one of the most important, if not the most important, positions inside state government, outside of being governor of Louisiana. So I suspect, based on the fact that I see you on the front page almost every day, you know you're in a prominent position, and you're aware that the actions you're taking are gaining lots of attention.
I am, and I think that that's a significant responsibility and one I take very seriously. I was fortunate to start my career in healthcare, serving some of the most underserved populations in the state, and moved on and was fortunate to do work at the Department of Children and Family Services, also serving the state's most vulnerable children, those that are at risk of being abused or neglected. And so I certainly have a perspective in terms of how to deliver and what services are critical at the state level, and services that really do save people's lives, and that's always going to stay with me. And then I also have the perspective of being an administrator and making tough decisions about, as you continue to provide those services and protect the people that need to be protected, how to do that in the context of constraints, whether it be budgetary constraints or other constraints.
Well, before we get to the budget that was unveiled Friday of last week, what about the debate on Capitol Hill right now and the sequestration controversy? How will that affect Louisiana?
We're looking right now at the impact if that were to come to pass. You know, our approach, and I think the approach that the federal government should take, is that, you know, to the extent that we have to make decisions about reductions, we have to do what we've done in this budget and that we continue to do in this administration, and that is to make tough decisions, look at cuts that protect critical services like higher education and health care, and make good administrative decisions about where to make reductions that are smart and that limit the impact on, you know, on people and those services that I mentioned. And I think that that's what needs to be done at the federal level.
Every cut has a constituency. It's not an easy thing, is it?
It's not. But, you know, what is important to remember is that we always have a responsibility in government and otherwise to, regardless of you know, our budgetary climate, to look at the way that we deliver services to make sure that we can do so in a way that is as efficient as possible. And that's an ongoing process. Everyone should be doing that daily. And I think that there will always be opportunities to, whether it be use technology or other ways to shrink the footprint of government in this case, but to also be very prudent and wise with taxpayer dollars and how you use them, and also consider the lives that you impact every day.
Now, how closely are you involved in the discussions about the tax reform plan?
Secretary Barfield is doing a very good job. He is leading that effort, obviously along with the governor. And so they're really taking that charge and managing that process. I'm managing the budget, obviously. The tax reform effort will be budget neutral. So as I move the budget forward and through the legislative process, the tax reform package will move along in a parallel effort.
So you're counting on the tax reform plan, if it's enacted, to be the same amount of money that would be coming in if you didn't have reform.
Yes, absolutely.
And your job is to count the beans regarding the $24.7 billion budget.
That's right.
All right. Well, today, I'm sure you've seen the front page of The Advocate. Jindal wants $100 million from NO Center, the New Orleans Convention Center. What's going on with this?
Well, let me just take a step back just to give your listeners a perspective in terms of the budget overall. We have, as you mentioned, a $24.7 billion budget this year. That's $1 billion smaller than the budget that we had last year. You know that we were faced with significant reductions to our FMAP rate. That's the rate that reimburses us for Medicaid services, and that's the federal government's share. After we left session last year, immediately after we left session last year, Congress acted and essentially took our FMAP rate and reduced it to the lowest rate in 25 years. And the overall impact of that reduction was $1.8 billion to the Medicaid budget when you look at last fiscal year and this fiscal year. And so obviously we're making reductions in terms of the overall budget itself. We're faced with a significant change in the way that we manage the Medicaid program. And so as we approached the budget and dealt with those constraints and dealt with them responsibly, we've been able to make some, I think, significant strides in the budget in that in this year we've protected higher education. We've not cut higher education's budget. We've protected critical services through healthcare and really mitigated some significant cuts there. There are no rate cuts to Medicaid providers. We don't have any closure of whether it be healthcare facilities or prison facilities in this budget. And we've also made some significant strides in terms of continuing to look at how we can structure government. We're consolidating some of the offices across state government that manage human resources, technology, management, and finance to get significant reductions. So we're doing the work that needs to be done to live within our means and live within the budget that we've provided, but also to be very cognizant of protecting the people that we serve. And in that process, we've been very forthcoming in our deliberations with legislators that we have used funds that are available to us, and we don't apologize for that. And one source of funding that we've looked at, among others, is looking at, for example, selling some of the state's assets, state buildings that are underutilized.
Mm-hmm.
That's one source of revenue that we've included in the budget. That was about $50 million. And we took a very deliberate approach in how we assessed what facilities we would include in that budget. And a great example of one underutilized asset is the state office building that is in the heart of downtown Baton Rouge and really prime real estate, where that building holds 400 people and there are only less than 100 people occupying that facility today. That's something that the Baton Rouge community is interested in. So we're looking at ways
this is at Second and Convention.
That's right. And that's right.
How much is that building worth on the open market?
The appraisal was $10 million. Facility is served by a garage across the street. That garage is also underutilized. So, again, those are we think, smart ways to reinvest taxpayer dollars into critical services. With respect to the convention center, the bottom line with the convention center is that the convention center, the city, and the city stakeholders are interested in development in the city and looking at a master plan for the right way to continue the development of New Orleans and that region. The funds that are provided in the convention center's budget are reserve funds. They do have a reserve account. This is a state facility. And so we're looking at the use of those reserve funds. The convention center had always anticipated utilizing those reserve funds for development projects. So this is not a new purpose for the reserve funds, but we're simply going to utilize capital outlay dollars for capital development and do that in concert with the city and with the convention center and with the stakeholders in the city and do a development that the region wants and that's a good investment in that area.
Now, the reports are the state is $1.3 billion short as far as the money needed to keep current levels of state government. If you get $100 million from the convention center, now you're $1.2 billion short, if those numbers are accurate. Where do you look to make up the gap?
I'm not sure what 1.3 you're referencing. There has been discussions about moving this funding into our capital outlay projects, and that's we've had some discussions over the last few months with Bond Commission and with the Treasurer's Office with respect to financing capital development long term and our debt limit. Fortunately, some of the debt limit projections, and that's the money that you can borrow for ongoing construction projects, the debt limit calculations were not correct. And we have sufficient funding for our construction projects going forward. The reality is we have significant opportunities and many options in terms of how we finance construction going forward, and we do not have an issue with respect to the ability to continue construction projects today and to move forward with construction projects going forward.
Higher education, of course, is another hot topic, and according to reports, college tuition would rise by $75 million under the new budget.
Well, that's not a new initiative. I'm sure you're aware that the governor in higher education and the legislature passed critical reforms in higher education through what's referenced as the Grad Act. There was Grad Act 1, and Grad Act 1 is really what's reflected in the budget today, and that is simply that higher education campuses can raise their tuition up to a cap depending on their overall performance. So to the extent that a higher education system and campus is doing a good job at graduating students and producing students that enter the marketplace and are well prepared to join the workforce, they're mm-hmm. effectively rewarded by being able to adjust their tuition if they so desire. And that tuition adjustment was always planned. The campuses have it planned in their budget, and that's what's reflected in the budget today.
877-217-5757, wherever you may be, for Christy Nichols. She is the Commissioner of Administration, the primary person who monitors the budget and enacts it for Governor Bobby Jindal. And last week, the Jindal administration pushed forward a $24.7 billion budget proposal. You say it's $1 billion less than a year ago?
Yes.
So where is the billion that was there a year ago? Where has it gone?
We've made about, over $300 million in savings, actual reductions across agencies. And we were able to shrink the growth of the budget by not funding what we typically refer to as sort of utilization increases or inflationary increases, not budgeting for merit increases, not budgeting for inflation in the budget, effectively not budgeting for growth. And then I've mentioned some of the ways that we've projected additional revenue into the budget. And in addition to that, just leveraging federal funds and other sources of funding. And so that's really what comprises the $1 billion.
297-5633 is the local number. Wade at Louie's. Wade, you're on the air with Commissioner Nichols. Hi, Wade.
Hi, I appreciate you taking my call. Don't you think it's about time to start raising some revenues, some real taxes, instead of selling off assets, long-term assets, to pay short-term operating expenses?
No, I think that the governor's been clear. We're not raising taxes. I personally, having worked in government for the last 10 years, strongly believe that it's important to continue to make reductions and to balance reductions by, aggressively looking at every option that you can to produce savings and to find additional revenue. And I think that historically that's been true in the budget. The concept of not using revenue that's available to you in a given year, we've looked historically, and that's always been true in the budget. And I think that the taxpayers expect us, in this example that you used, to look at underutilized state buildings or properties. Why would we want to retain those on the books and keep those assets when they're not utilized and they can be sold and enter the marketplace and are of value to the community? And I think it's responsible for us to utilize that revenue so that we continue to provide critical services.
What about privatization in other areas, hospitals, for example? How does this help the budget situation, in your estimation?
That's a great question. I mentioned the reductions with respect to Medicaid reimbursement for Louisiana and the federal share, and that really gave us an opportunity to look at the state's public hospital infrastructure and to find ways to deliver public services and public mm-hmm. hospital services in partnership with providers that are local and providing hospital services in those communities today. And I think that's created a new environment for public hospital services. It's no secret that we're one of the few states in the country, and I think we're the only state in the country, to have a single public hospital system. Many of the states in our country administer public health services and hospital services at the community level in partnership, not just with mm-hmm. private entities, but with public entities. And we're emulating that, and it's not a new model. You know, the reality is we had, prior to the FMAP reductions, once we made the reductions to the Medicaid budget as it relates to LSU Hospital Services, after the FMAP rate reductions, we were faced with a $300 million reduction in the public hospital budget. That was our mid-year reduction. As we entered into negotiations with private hospitals mm-hmm. and hospitals that are serving communities that are also served by LSU hospitals, and as we joined with them in these public-private ventures, we've been able to reduce the cut that would have been made to the LSU hospital infrastructure by $200 million. And that's because the private hospitals are making investments in our public hospital infrastructure, and we're able to continue to deliver the services. And we've also been able to reduce some of the cuts that would have been made had we not entered into those private hospital arrangements.
Jim in Woodstone. Jim, good morning. You're on the air with Christy Nichols, the Commissioner of Administration for Governor Bobby Jindal.
Christy, I would just like to ask you a question, having been on the foundation for the charity hospitals. How are you going to save money by having physicians see patients when in the charity system we had one physician with $740,000 a year resident seeing these patients? And I understand that none of your contracts are confirmed yet, and yet we're coming into the time that they take effect, and you're killing the local hospitals. The Bogalusa Hospital will be reduced to 8 or 10 patients.
Go ahead.
Thank you for that question. The reality is we've, again, moved forward with the challenge of the reduction in the federal Medicaid rates and looked at ways to transform and to continue to provide public hospital services. We've looked at, for example, the cost structure of the public hospital system. And when you ask the question about how do we save money in the private-public partnership, as the private hospitals, for example, take over the services that are provided by the public hospitals, by leveraging those economies of scale that exist in those private hospitals, we're able to reduce the cost of providing the same care that was provided in the public hospital system. And the reality is that same service in the public hospital system was very costly on a per unit basis and per patient basis. And so those are some of the ways we're making savings. We're also generating and leveraging financing opportunities with the private hospitals. They're investing in leases, and they're effectively leasing the hospitals themselves and making capital investments that the public hospital couldn't afford to do. That's another way that we're generating revenue in addition to benefiting from a reduced cost structure in the private hospital setting.
297-5633. We'll return with Christy Nichols. She's the Commissioner of Administration for Governor Bobby Jindal. Much to talk about regarding the state budget as we continue the conversation with Christy after this 90-second timeout. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Christy Nichols is our guest, the Commissioner of Administration, and please be brief. We have some folks who obviously are engaged and ready to talk to Christy about matters of importance regarding the state budget. Carl at LSU, good morning, Carl. You're on the air with Christy.
Yes. Ms. Nichols?
You're on the air, Carl.
Good morning.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Nichols, I'm calling from LSU, and the rumor here is that the next step in the general administration is to privatize the state universities. Is that true?
No.
Thank you.
Nothing to that.
No, there's nothing to that. I did want to go back to the question of LSU hospitals and the private partnership. I think one thing that we've not talked enough about, and I think it's very important, is the graduate medical education component of the LSU Public Hospital system, and LSU's done a great job of educating our medical residents, for many decades, and they continue to do a good job. I think what's exciting about our opportunities with private hospitals is that mm-hmm. medical residents get additional training opportunities that they otherwise wouldn't have. They get the public hospital setting, and they get the benefits of that from a medical training perspective, but they also get the partnership with a private hospital and the expanded services that are sometimes provided in those private hospital settings. And they get the benefit of both modes of training, which I think is very exciting. It allows us to look at our financing for medical education, and it also allows us to give a broader experience to those medical residents.
Now, Kobe Menard writes, I work for a pediatric daycare or day health center. Our patients are Medicaid patients whose eligibility is based on their diagnosis, not their income. What are the future budget plans with regards to Medicaid eligibility and income, and how does it affect these patients?
I think Secretary Greenstein's better prepared to talk about the specific reductions within DHH's budget. I don't believe that in the executive budget that we've presented that pediatric day health has seen reductions. But again, I think Secretary Greenstein's probably better prepared to go into specifics.
Now, what about the governor being steadfast in his reluctance or refusal to accept the Medicaid expansion that is part of Obamacare? What do you make of this, and how does it affect the budget?
Well, I mean, we've balanced the budget and done so irrespective of Medicaid expansion, and that's always been our position. I think that for Medicaid and the discussion of expansion, the reason that we were not participating in Medicaid expansion is very clear. The way that Medicaid expansion has been structured is it is the expansion of Medicaid as it exists today, and the challenges that we face today, even with the current Medicaid population and the rules surrounding Medicaid prior to the Affordable Care Act, was that the program in totality needs to be structured in a way that gives the states flexibility to provide services in a way that's reflective of that state's needs and also reflective of the state's budgets. And Medicaid today at the federal level doesn't give you that option. It's a program that, you know, is called an entitlement program, and that means that you have to serve the people that are within the program guidelines, and you have to provide the level of service that's prescripted or prescribed by the federal government, and that creates many challenges. It doesn't necessarily create a program that meets the needs of those that are served, and it certainly creates opportunities for the program to have cost overruns that are significant and create significant challenges for the states. And although I think many people talk about, you know, the federal match rate for Medicaid expansion and the opportunity to cover more people, the reality is the state will be faced with the coverage of almost a half a billion more people on Medicaid rolls over the next, you know, 10 years and going forward.
Half a billion?
That's right. Over 400 million people stand to would be added to the Medicaid program through the expansion. That's a 40% growth in the program.
400 million?
That's right. I'm sorry, 400,000. I apologize, Jim.
400,000.
That's right. I'm sorry, half a million.
Okay.
I'm dealing in budget numbers at this point.
What happens to those 400,000 if the governor does not not make a change in plan and accept Obamacare? What happens to them in the short term?
Well, we continue to serve populations that have been served through the state's Medicaid program, and we'll continue to do that. We're moving, in this year's budget, which I announced on Friday, moving some of the coverage of those that were previously covered in Medicaid into the health insurance and move their actual coverage into the health insurance pools. And so those are going to be provided by the health insurance exchange. And we'll continue to meet the needs of our residents and look at the ways that we can structure the Medicaid program. We've made a lot of advances in better managing care through the Bayou Health Program and through the Behavioral Health Initiative. And that's just effectively looking at ways to provide case management and a continuum of care across primary care to specialty care that manages care that's directed at the patient and the patient's needs, and also looks at ways to contain costs by meeting needs at a primary care level, making sure people have a medical home, and making sure they're effectively case managed versus effectively just being in a Medicaid system and seeking care wherever they can get care and not necessarily having their health managed by a physician in a coordinated manner. So we've used Bayou Health as a way to continue to provide coverage and even expand coverage in some instances. We've expanded coverage for mental health services for children. We've made significant advances in providing behavioral health support to children with severe emotional disturbances and just children across the board who have mental health issues. We've done that by providing case management and rigor to the Medicaid program while expanding services. And those are the approaches that we'll continue to take.
From a financial perspective, will it cost more to do it your way or to accept the provisions in the Affordable Care Act?
Obviously, you know, looking at your state Medicaid budget, managing the program and looking at health outcomes and the best way to case manage and coordinate care and contain costs is a more effective way and cost-effective way and better
health. So you're saying the state will save money by not accepting the provisions in the Obamacare Act?
Again, by accepting Medicaid expansion, we need to understand that not only are we expanding the Medicaid population by 40%, we're also taking people who were previously covered by health insurance, and those people are now eligible to enroll in Medicaid. So not only do you have just a growth in the program, and the program continues to be structured as it is today without the appropriate cost containment measures, but you also have created the ability for almost 100,000 people to move into the Medicaid program who were previously purchasing their private health insurance.
Okay. Christy Nichols is our guest, the Commissioner of Administration. Linda in River Oaks. Hi, Linda. You're on the air with Christy.
Hi, Christy. I hear you talk a good game, darling, but most of the people in the state are so discouraged about the education and about the health situation and that you're dismantling everything that has worked relatively good for the people and was getting better.
All right. Do you have a question, Linda? That was a statement. Do you have a question to accompany your statement?
Yes. Will you lay out exactly what your criteria is going to be for the young children to get into Medicare?
To Medicaid, I guess, is what she meant to say.
Well, children are covered currently in the Medicaid program up to, I believe it's 250% of poverty are covered. So children in the Medicaid program today are being seen by pediatricians all across the state, and that's provided through the LaChip program. The state has won national awards for enrolling all children, as many children that can be enrolled that are eligible for the program, and Medicaid's done great strides in serving the children's population. And when you look at education for children, when you look at the K-12 system, for example, our budget has never reduced funding for K-12. And in fact, the K-12 budget since our administration began has grown by 10%. So we've been funding for student growth. We've been making adjustments in the MFP based on other adjustments that are seen in the school systems and been financing education for our children in that setting. And we've worked with higher education to reduce the cuts to higher education to the extent that we can.
The state stands to receive some money from BP as a result of the ongoing litigation. Where will this money go if the state gets a handsome payout?
We've not made those decisions yet. We've been watching the negotiations carefully, of course, and we'll make decisions about the best use of those funds as the negotiations unfold and we know what that funding is going to be.
Could the money possibly be put in the general fund?
Like I said, we've not even entered into discussions with the legislature and internally about how we're going to use BP settlement funds.
Albert at Southern University, this is Dr. Samuels. Good morning to you, sir. You're on with Christy Nichols.
Good morning, Jim, and good morning, Ms. Nichols. Quick question. The administration keeps saying that it can't participate in the Medicaid expansion because it's not flexible enough. But yet you're using, under the current law, you've already initiated the Bayou Health Initiative that works for private insurers already. So my question is,
it seems like you're not really being straight with the public.
No, and thank you for the question, number one. Bayou Health is an example of how we've worked within the existing Medicaid framework and managed and created a managed program that focuses on coordinated care within the confines of the existing federal program. We're still required to provide all of the benefits that are required by Medicaid today, and we're still required to provide those benefits to all that are eligible for Medicaid today. And there are no ways to structure around those two components of the Medicaid program. That's those that are required to be covered and the full array of benefits that are provided in Medicaid. And as you look at serving more people, a growth of what I mentioned was 40%, you are still required to serve all of the income levels that are prescribed under the new federal law, and you're required to provide the Medicaid benefits that are already prescribed for Medicaid today. And the point is that it makes it very difficult to design a Medicaid plan for your state that's reflective of targeting the populations in your state that may be most in need, and targeting services that meet the needs of those that are in need. And so structuring healthcare services in a manner that meets the needs of those in your state that are struggling, and that takes into account the state's budget as you design those eligibility packages. And that's the difference.
Stephen in Central Highlands, please be brief, Stephen. You're on with Commissioner Nichols.
Yes. Louisiana Treasurer John Kennedy said, quote, according to both the business plans for the new big charity, the hospital will go bankrupt if we are not part of the Medicaid portion of the Affordable Care Act.
Okay. You may have a different opinion than Treasurer Kennedy, who's slated to be on the show tomorrow, by the way, but what do you think?
Well, I've worked on UMC and the development of that hospital over the last 5 to 6 years, ever since Katrina. So I am familiar with that business plan. And the reality is that business plan, to be a strong business plan, has to look at not only serving the uninsured and the underserved, but also has to be a major regional driver of medical education and medical research. And that is the focus of UMC going forward. Not simply to be a public hospital system, but to be a major medical institution, not only for the region and this for the state, but also for this region. And that creates a business plan where you have opportunities to have a payer mix that's reflective of those that are insured in the not only in New Orleans, but in the state and in the region. And that is the business plan that will be successful for UMC in New Orleans. And as of late, the UMC board has entered into a partnership with Children's Hospital in New Orleans, creating even additional opportunities to provide services that are highly needed in the area and highly needed in the region. And that creates the ability for that hospital to profit from not only the insured market, but competitively exist in the region as a major medical institution.
Shane in New Iberia, please be brief, Shane. You're on with Commissioner Nichols.
Sure. You know, I'm from the UL Lafayette area, and its budget's been cut by 45% since 2008. If enough people speak out between, you know, by email or letter or petitions, would the governor consider restoring some of the college budgets in Louisiana?
I mentioned this earlier. We, as we looked at moving forward past mid-year, we made a concerted decision, an effort not to reduce higher education budget, and we're committed to that going forward. And we're working with higher education to look at the options. And I know higher education is very interested in looking at options where they can make decisions as entities to increase their revenue and retain that revenue. So we've not cut higher education. We're committed to that in this budget. And as we move forward in partnership with higher education, I know we're looking at opportunities to raise revenue on campuses.
Final question for Commissioner Nichols, Dan downtown. Dan, please be brief. You're on with Christy Nichols. Hi, Dan.
Hi. Has the administration considered reinstating the deli plan so as to raise revenue from those best able to pay?
Any thoughts of reinstating the STELE plan?
Again, Secretary Barfield is managing the tax reform plan, and I'll let him field those questions. No, I don't think so.
And he, Secretary Barfield, is slated to be with us next week. I think next Tuesday. So hopefully we will be able to visit with him. He had scheduled an appearance a few weeks ago and lost his sister. So he will be with us. And we thank you for being with us today. Are you enjoying your work?
I am. I really am enjoying the work. I appreciate you asking.
You have a tough job.
It's an honor to serve the state. It's an honor to be challenged with I think what you said earlier, which is some of the most important work that you can do in state government and in a career. And I take that very seriously. And I'm honored to serve.
Well, thank you. Hopefully we'll have you back sometime soon, Christy.
I appreciate
thank
it.
You. And today, of course, is final day on the job for Pope Benedict the 16th. That's a story that will have relevance that we will cover right here on WRKF. Today was the final day of MASH in 1983, 30 years ago, episode number 251. And we lost Van Cliburn, the great pianist from Shreveport, front page of the New York Times today. A legend is gone. Until Monday, for Kevin, I'm Jim. Stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.